We are ready to begin the sectional with Dr. Robinson, and we've asked him to speak for his sectional on first-person expository preaching, and some of this has come recently with the work of his son, and so I'm going to let him I'm just introducing, getting it started. So once again, welcome Dr. Haddon Robinson.
I teach a Doctor of Ministry seminar in preaching. It's a three-year program. 2 weeks, 2 weeks, 2 weeks, over 3 years. We have people in that program that come from a variety of seminaries. And so one of the things I ask is, how'd you get here? Why are you in the program? As you would imagine, you get a variety of answers. But one answer that has come back several times that takes me by surprise is that, well, so I went through seminary, got some a lot of help on how to exegete the text. And I had a form that I use for preaching that I was given, usually a key word that you have. I developed a sermon out of it. And I've had several of them say, the reason I came is I'm bored with my own preaching. If you preached a lot, you know that that's always a danger. Sunday comes around every 4 days. And you find that, you know, you have a certain form and you put the sermon in that form. But after a while, it's like a cookie cutter, you know. Every sermon looks the same. And that doesn't matter whether you've got a passage in the Old Testament in, say, 2 Samuel, or you're dealing with a passage in the book of Romans, or you're dealing with a psalm. Sermons all have the same kind of shape. Three things we learn about grace from this story of the prodigal son. Four things we learn about worship from what David writes in Psalm 51. They all have that same ring to them. So one of the things we work at is how do you get some variety? And one answer to that is you get variety if you're an expositor, if you're really opening the scriptures, by looking at the form that the biblical writer takes. It is a matter to be noted that when God wanted to communicate his truth, the major way he did it was through narrative, through story. You take the whole Bible, probably just about 10% of it is in didactic literature, in the literature of the epistles. But the major way is through story. Men who wrote the Old Testament were theologians. They weren't just storytellers, they were theologians. And they had things they wanted to communicate about God to their people. And the genre that they used to communicate that was story. Fokelman, a Jewish scholar, who's done a great deal of work in the narrative of the Old Testament, makes the point that the authors of the Old Testament were corking good storytellers. In fact, he says, and he has studied them in minute detail, there is not a detail in the stories of the Old Testament that does not significantly or insignificantly, contribute to the punchline. There's no irrelevant detail, which is remarkable because you've got this, nomadic people, haven't produced much other literature, but they knew how to tell stories. They told stories to get across theology. Behind every story, there's always a vision of God, how God reveals himself, how the people responded. When Jesus came, he told stories. We call them parables. They weren't always to reveal the truth. Sometimes they were used to conceal, but they were stories. I think that's why in the Apostles' Creed, Jesus' whole teaching ministry is dismissed with a semicolon. He was born of the Virgin Mary, semicolon, suffered under Pontius Pilate. I think the reason for that is the theologians that put that together, never really considered Jesus a theologian. Who are the theologians of the New Testament? Well, Paul's a theologian. John's a theologian. You don't understand him. Peter's a theologian. But Jesus died for us, and that's what his contribution was, but he really wasn't a theologian. When I was in seminary, used to have the I remember the professors used to say, you can never base doctrine on a parable. I wrote that down, took it to be true. But you think that's monstrous nonsense. What Jesus was teaching, and doctrine sounds so stuffy, Jesus was teaching truth about God, about himself, about people, and how they respond. He was using a story. I guess some of you who've been in the South know that in the South they use the term story like a verb. Youngster's given some money to put in the offering at Sunday school. Comes home and says, hey, Ma, I lost the money for Sunday school. And the mother, who's a bit suspicious of the candy the kids got, says, son, are you storying me? It says, you know, story is equal to not being true. So one of the things you can do to get variety in your preaching is to look at the form in which the truth of God is communicated. Certainly there are times in which you have a didactic sermon, which you unfold the passage. But there are other times in which, say, you're dealing with a psalm. Psalms don't develop logically, but they deal with images. And a sermon based on the psalm deals with the images in the psalm. Not just a reference, but you develop it. The Psalm 1, you have basic images. A tree planted by the rivers of water and chaff. You can refer to that, but you can develop that. The psalmist does that. So when you come to a psalm, you cannot treat it like you would an epistle. Okay, make sense? And then when you look at the stories of the Bible, then you know that stories have their own rules. In order to interpret a story, one of the things you have to do is to determine where it starts, where it ends, where this episode begins and ends. You have to ask questions about why did the biblical writer include that here? What difference would it make if this episode wasn't here? What is the biblical writer doing? You have the list at the end of 2 Samuel of David's mighty men. Look at that list in Samuel and compare it to the chronicler. The list in 2 Samuel ends by referring to the man that David killed in order to cover up his sin with Bathsheba. It ends with Uriah the Hittite. The chronicler buries it. In fact, the chronicler cleans up the record. You don't have anything about David's sin with Bathsheba, but writer of 2 Samuel isn't that big a fan of David. He puts a lot of warts in here along with the story. But the very last person, I mean, it stands out. It's Uriah the Hittite. You say, why did he do that? I mean, why did he just bury it? Chronically. Because I think the key incident in some way in David's life was the sin with Bathsheba. The story of his sin with Bathsheba. And you read through 2 Samuel, that story just frames the rest of the book. And remember when Nathan confronted David? I mean, dangerous thing to confront a king. Dangerous thing to confront a king who has a guilty conscience. Dangerous thing to confront a king with a guilty conscience that's already killed a man to cover up what he's done. And Uriah goes to confront him. So he works on the introduction very strongly. Tells him a story. Majesty, there was a man here in the kingdom. And all kinds of sheep and herds. Across the road, there was a poor farmer. Had one little ewe lamb. It's like a pet. Fed it at his table. Took it to bed at night. Kept him warm. And this wealthy man with these herds and flocks had a visitor come. Instead of taking one of his own flock, he took his neighbor's little ewe lamb, killed that for the barbecue. And David was furious. He said, the man who did that deserves to die. He'll restore fourfold what he has taken. And Nathan said, sir, You're that man. If you look at the way the historian develops that story, following what happened, there are four things that go on in working out that story. The rebellion of Absalom, to the rebellion of Adonijah, to which the storyteller says of Adonijah, David did not rebuke him in his entire life. Why? Because the story. He had lost his moral base. He couldn't do it. So when he does this at the end and he refers to Uriah the Hittite, that's an echo from the story. The theologians and historians knew how to use stories. They used them deliberately because, you see four different things happening after David's sin. And the storyteller is a good storyteller and say, that's one, that's two, that's three. No, he just spins the story out. And a perceptive listener, because these stories were probably told orally before they were written down, hears that. So all of that is to say, if you're going to preach biblically, one part of your preaching is going to have to do with stories. Because God communicated his truth through stories. When I talk about story preaching or narrative preaching, I am not using it the way modern liberals do. You know, you have your story, I have my story, we tell the story, there's an overlapping somehow. Now, I believe there's a mega story, which we are a part. So this is not a move towards liberal theology, it's simply a move towards biblical form. So the first thing I'd say is that one of the things that ought to characterize our preaching from the Bible is that there's a large element of the story in it. Now, the second thing is to say there are many different ways to tell the story. Normally, you tell a story, you start at the beginning, go to the end. Other times, you start at the end and go back and see how we got there. Usually, you make your point at the end of the story, not at the beginning. Stories move inductively, but not always. Many ways to tell the story. And one of the ways to tell that story is by looking at the story from the point of view of one of the characters in the text. That's what we mean by a first-person narrative sermon. You take one character and look at that story through his eyes. It has biblical support. In the book of Daniel, you have Nebuchadnezzar telling his story, how he learned that God was sovereign over the affairs of men. And he tells it from the first person. This is Nebuchadnezzar talking. You get it in the book of Acts, sections of the book of Acts in which Luke stops talking like a historian, giving you the record, and becomes part of the story. We did this, the we sections. So there are times the biblical writers use a first-person narrative. The reason it works so well is that it's, first of all, a fresh way of coming at a truth, and you're always looking for that. But more important, we are attracted to testimony. We like to have people tell their story. Talk about it as a testimony. I spoke at a banquet in Washington this last week for the Good News Jail and Prison Chaplains. And they didn't need me. They had three people there who had been in prison and had been touched by a chaplain, and their lives were changed, and they had these three people give their testimony. You know, the testimony, look at the mess I was in, and I heard the good news about Jesus Christ. Christ got hold of me, and I'm changed. Look, you know, here's where I am now. And you sat there. You know, they weren't particularly skilled as speakers. That didn't matter. They were telling us their story. And it, you know, it was a fundraising thing. I got up there to do my talk, but they had raised the money because those three people were telling their story. So there is that effect when you're doing it. So how do you do it? How do you go about doing a first-person narrative? Well, first of all, you've got to do exegesis in the text. This is not an easy way to go about preparing for Sunday. Though many times it is more interesting to do because you're using both sides of your brain. You're using your right side, where you have to analyze what's going on, then you use your left side to use it imaginatively to enter into that story. And what you're trying to do is to look at the story and look at the point that the biblical writer is making with that story. And then take a character in the story and become that character. And then tell the story from that person's vantage point. Last Christmas, I was asked to speak at a gathering at the seminary. And I began by saying, my name is Joseph Davidson. And many of you know me, but you don't know me very well. I have a lot to do with your Christmas story, but sometimes I feel like the father of the bride at the wedding. Nobody really notices him, but the whole affair costs him a great deal. And what you call Christmas costs me dearly. Let me tell you a bit about myself. I'm a carpenter. I don't know if that means anything to you, but it tells you something about me. I'm a practical sort of man. People like me aren't into vague philosophies or abstractions. We like what we can measure and cut, feel. We like wood. Many different kinds of wood. Wood has a kind of spirit to it. There are woods that are soft. They're almost like clay where you can move. Others are hard, almost like metal. I personally like hard wood, sturdy. But at any rate, let me tell you how and off I went. Talked about that story from Joseph's point of view. I preached at the Promise Keepers down in Dallas. 80,000 people, that's a big congregation. And I just walked out and said, my name is David Jesseson. Not many people know me by that name. In fact, folks just know me as David. Nobody ever calls me Dave. But I was a success. I mean, by anybody's standards, ancient or modern, I was a success. And I talked about all the things that I had done. But there was one area in which I failed. I failed with my son. And then I took the passage, you know, Absalom, my son Absalom. One of the most overwhelmingly touching passages. And talked about Absalom and how, I was busy. I mean, I had kingdoms to run. I had treaties to negotiate. So when he was small, he never able to bring me a broken toy. I didn't have time for that. I guess when he became a man, it never occurred to him to bring me a broken heart. And I developed that. And it's something else, I guess even more important. Crucial time in my life, I failed him. The moment of a deep temptation, I committed adultery. I was so caught up with that, covering it up, trying to escape it, so caught up. I thought I'd done it, but then it came out. Everybody knew. And Absalom knew. And I talked about Absalom, his rape of Tamar, and how that disintegrated in the family, and then how he rebelled against me, and how I tried to keep him from destroying himself, and then he got me out of the city of Jerusalem and went to the city of Manasseh. And I sent the men, our men, to battle against Absalom, his soldiers. On the way out, I said, look, don't hurt the young man. For my sake, don't touch him. And I talked about how it was, what it was like to wait, and then the messengers came back and told me that Joab, my general, had killed him. Same man who had killed Uriah, no, it was so true that he did that. I spun it out. So I came to tell you the story of my failure. Not so that you could sit in judgment on me, but so that I could warn you, busy as you are. God used it in a significant way. Months, in fact, years later, I've heard from men who, in fact, I came to the end of it and I said, look, you're here, you're men with their boys, and I want you to do something. I want you to get into groups with, you know, sons and dads together. And if you're a son, I want you to take a few moments and just pray for your dad. He's there, put your arm around him. It's tough to be a dad these days. And some of you men have never in your life told your son how much you love him. I mean, you've never singled him out and said, look, I don't care what you do or don't do in life. I want you to know I really love you and value you. I'm going to give you a chance to do that right now. Or you're here, but you don't have your daughter here, but you know what I'm talking about. I want you to covenant right now, and maybe there'll be a man next to you who doesn't have a son here. Two of you, covenant together that you're going to call your daughter, get with your daughter if there's a rift between you. And ask for forgiveness. Get that thing settled. I had all kinds of men tell me. That was the first time in their life the father had ever said to him, son, I love you. Really appreciate you. I just want you to know that. First time father had ever heard a son pray for him. Guy said that they left the stadium right after I spoke and went out. Got on a phone, called their daughter, said, look, I've got to talk to you. Married daughter. You know, I've got to get with you. I got with her. And for years, they really hadn't talked. And got settled. All I'm saying is that out of that narrative, somehow God spoke and touched people. Because it was the testimony of a king who in his success had lost his son. So what you do is you look at the story and you work it through as you would any story, and then it's like, where can I enter this? Don Senukian has a story on the book of Esther. Has a first-person narrative from the book of Esther. And he enters it from the point of view of a servant, who I think is mentioned once in the text, but he's telling the story through his eyes. That's the vantage point. Christmas ago, I did a first-person narrative with my son in his church, in which he interviewed me. I was Herod. I had done a lot of research on Herod, a lot to know about him. Historians were the ones who called him Herod the Great. Well, he built the temple. He built an astonishing number of buildings. You know, he was great. And he was also very ticked off that Sunday morning because people treated him like a comic character. Some kid in a pageant referred to him as Herod the Grape. Now don't laugh. Nobody in my day would have done that. Nobody in my day would have dared to do it. And I talked about who he was and how great he was. And how he gets a bad rap because this baby that was born wasn't very significant. And he had to wipe him out. I mean, you call those men that came wise men, they were stupid. You don't come to a sitting king like me and tell me there's a pretender to my throne that's born and expect me to just sit there and take it. Well, I mean, I had to deal with him. And I know you know, make a big thing out of it, you Christians, you call it the slaughter of the innocents. Ah, there wasn't more than 50 boys at Bethlehem at that time, 2 years old and under. Man, if you think that's big, you think killing children means anything? Some of you do it. Your culture, you kill all kinds of pre-barns. And some of you don't have the guts to do it. The people that you work with, that if you could, you'd like to wipe them out, get them out of the way. Yeah, you don't be so morally superior to me. You know, and anyhow, in the book that we put, Tori and I put together, we put an account of that. But what are your questions about this? I'm not sure what else you need to know that would help you. That's a neat question and an important question. Just as interpretation of a text is one step removed from the text, because what you've got is the text. And then how we interpret it is one step removed from the text. So in developing a first person or any narrative, your imagination is one step removed from the text. The biblical writers, in telling a story, expected you to use your imagination. I mean, that's what a storyteller does. Expected you to get inside of it, whether you tell the first person or not. Where the danger comes is you use your imagination one step away from the text, and then you make deductions on this one step, and then you get into fantasy. But if you look at the biblical material, what you've got, you're expected to enter into it, to hear it with your imagination. And you do that. If I say to you, well, let me back up to show you what I mean. Whenever a person starts, hermeneutically, you put yourself into gear. If I say, dearly beloved, we are gathered here today, what do you expect? Yeah, a wedding. Well, maybe a funeral, but what it is. If I say, the party of the first part will owe to the party of the second part, what do you expect? Contract, okay? If I say, how do I love you? Let me count the ways. What do you expect? Okay? If I say, once upon a time, what do you expect? Story. You hear a story, you set your mind hermeneutically in a different framework than if you read a legal contract. And you say, what are you doing? Well, you're entering into that story. You're seeing it. You're experiencing it. And if you do your work, that is the background of the text, understand the history of the text, then you're able to enter into it, and it's based on the text, but one step removed. Okay. That's an interesting question. I think I'm sure there are things that ways I preach now that I wouldn't have preached when I was in my 20s, 30s. But that had to do with what I thought preaching was. Right? It had a certain form and it was oratorical and so forth. When I went for 10 years, I was the general director of the Christian Medical Dental Association, and I preached to doctors and dentists and spoke at medical school. I discovered, boy, that you know, declarative, dramatic form of the sort that, you know, what you usually think of as preaching, of course, didn't work. They were a tough audience. And so I found that I had to develop a much more conversational way of speaking. Doctors were a tough audience. They'll come in and they'll sit there with their arms folded. You can tell them your best joke. And they give you two teeth. I mean, they are a tough audience. But I realized I had to talk with them, not at them. And until that time, I thought talking at them was the way to come at it. So I guess what I'm saying is, as I have gone through life, I've changed a lot because of my experiences. But you don't have to do that. You know, you can live and learn, or you can learn and live. Better to learn and live. But I, you know, if you really think about, if you listen to conversations, I mean, I think as a good preacher, you ought to listen to conversations. I don't mean listen as you listen to a person. Obviously, you'll do that. But listen to the way conversations go on. You know, sometimes you have four or five people talk. Just back off and listen. And people always talk about people. Always talk about people doing things. They don't gossip about ideas. If we gossiped about ideas, we'd be a race of mental giants. We don't do that, you know. Listen to that. And listen to the way people talk. And once they begin to talk in telling their account, they're very specific, use a lot of details. There's often an element of conflict in it. Not because they're good storytellers, but when you're telling your story, you just do that narrative, that naturally. There's always an element of narrative of the character saying, you know, I said to her, and she said to me. Then I said, and what you've got is dialogue. You got that this morning when Glenn was preaching. He did a dialogue there with Peter. But that goes on in conversation all the time. So if you listen to conversation, you can become a good storyteller. If you read a novel, a John Grisham novel, easy reading. But look at the way he develops it. Or look at Time magazine, how they tell their story. They start off almost invariably telling you about people. Their rule is find the people in the story. And the Bible gives you that. And so you can do it as a young man, but it forces you to think about it and get into the mind of the character. And the more research you've done, the more easily you're able to do it. And I preach for 5 months at Grace Chapel in Lexington, Massachusetts. At the end of the 5 months, a number of people wrote to me to thank me. I'm sure somebody put them up to it, a whole bunch of letters. And they thanked me for the preaching, for the sermons. But my wife pointed out, when they referred to particular sermons that had touched them, without exception, it was a first-person narrative. I think I preached three, and those were the three sermons when they wanted to be specific came through. So it's a matter of just using your imagination, coming at it and getting inside the story. What did the, if you look at the story of the prodigal son, and by the way, we ought not call it the prodigal son, it's the waiting father. But how did he feel? What was it like? What was it like to look at that story from the point of view of the elder brother? You know, we sort of go through reading it. We did on our radio program, the prodigal son, spent quite a bit of time on it. And we got we had letters from people who were furious, I mean really angry with us, because we made the elder brother, who was like the Pharisees, into the bad guy. Been doing it intentionally, but here he was out of sympathy with the father's heart, out of sympathy with the father's concern. People wrote in, they were angry. Hadn't been for that boy, the kid who went to the far country wouldn't have had a home to come home to. You know, you haven't read the story correctly. I think he's the hero of the story. What interested me was that I'm sure they came from elder brothers and sisters who, you know, gotten into that and said, yeah, you think I'm, this kid is taken off with the family fortune and I'm left here, plow the field and you're making me the bad guy. And, you know, it's interesting how people enter into a story like that. We entered into it, they entered into it. And that they don't do that when you're just preaching at them. You had your hand up, I'm sorry. Say that to me again. You've been on a screen? On a screen? Yeah. I rely on the oral, but that's just because I don't know anything about technology. I've seen visuals used very well. The visual has to serve the sermon and not be done for its own sake. You know, I want to show everybody I'm in the technological age. You can't do that. But if you say, no, the best way to get this across is to show a film clip, then if that's the best way to get that across, like a good illustration. If you tell the story for the story's sake, it's a bad story, and it's not an illustration. But if you tell the story because it illumines the point, do it. The biggest danger is that if you use those in your sermon as you're moving towards it, that the film clip becomes more interesting than your sermon. On the other hand, if you can tell the story well, details, dialogue, it's amazing the pictures people have inside their minds. When I was growing up, they had radio drama, Inner Sanctum, and they'd never made a film as scary as those radio dramas, squeaking drawer. It was done in my mind. I listened to Garrison Keillor. I mean, he knows how to tell a story. You can see Lake Wobegon. And I'm told that people go to Wisconsin or Minnesota, you know, asking how to get there. I mean, they can see it. Good storytellers, you know, can do that. And but having said all of that, visuals can be very, very helpful if you use them well. And they serve you and you don't serve them, yeah. Yeah, that's a neat question. One of the problems we face today is how do we cross generations? And secondly, how do we cross cultures? Many of the churches that are growing, you know, will have Asians and African Americans, you know, Caucasian, Hispanics, and they're all, my son has a church like that in Tarrytown, New York. He has people from the Caribbean, and he's got a large group. He has to preach cross-culturally, and then he has people in the church that are 70, folks who are 17, and so forth. The narrative works with all those groups. Everybody loves a story. And look, we watch television, and television is a storied medium. I mean, they tell you the big story, they tell you the little story. They tell you the big story of Law and Order, whatever it is, and then in order to tell you the commercial, and that becomes a little story. People watch television 29 hours a week. Even ball games. My son's a sportscaster. Before they do a ball game, he worked with the ESPN, they go in and decide what the storyline is. Watch Monday Night Football. In the first 2 minutes, they have cartoons in which they set up the story for the game. They're not just two teams playing each other. if Kurt Warner gets a chance to be the quarterback, boy, you know what that story is. He didn't do well. They're about to get rid of him. Now he's second in command, but now he's got a chance to show himself today. You know, can he do it? And that becomes a storyline. Red Sox, the storyline is they're under the curse of Babe Ruth. I've come to believe it myself. But, you know, can they overcome the curse this year? There's a storyline. When you watch news, it's a news story. That's how people get their information. That's how they get their news. Throughout history, before print, that was how people communicated their laws, the mores. But anyhow, I think it crosses all kinds of lines. Yes? Well, when I'm just preaching, not using a narrative sermon, I do. I look for the images. I preach without notes, teach our students to preach without notes and manuscript. And the way you do it is by thinking with pictures in your head. And it turns out that that's also a way of having good communication. So you're working with abstractions followed by specifics. If all you have are specifics, then you have what's called a skyscraper sermon, one story after another, nothing much in between. But you have the broad abstract assertion that's important, but then you follow it with specifics. So I'm constantly asking, how can I get people to see this and thus experience it and feel it? And so even within a regular sermon, if you're using an illustration, and it's an important illustration, you really need to give details. Not just the car went down the road, but the old 56 Ford rumbled down the road. You know? No, not down the road, down the highway, down the path. I want to see it. If I can, I want to get dialogue, not just he said to her, she said, but actually have them do it. And then when you tell it, you've got to enter into it. You have to relive the story, not retell it. If you can relive it, or you can see it yourself, it's amazing. It affects your gestures. It affects the inflection of your voice. So that whenever I use narrative of any sort, I try to do that. Sure, and you're right. And the illustration I chose could lead you to that. But in the broader sense, it's the Red Sox against the Yankees. That's a big story. That's the whole group against the whole group.
I want from the church and what?
But the answer is, let me affirm what you're saying. When Paul wrote to his epistles, more often the you is not a singular, it's a plural. But I am not saying, I want to tell you my story is mine. I really want you to enter into it with me together. I mean, that's what you're trying to do. So, when you're talking in a sermon, you want the whole church to understand, but that church doesn't respond unless the individuals in that church respond. So I have to keep that framework in mind, especially when I make application. I don't think the use of narrative goes one way or another with that. The question you're asking is a very valid question in the church today, but I don't think whether you use narrative or not doesn't change that. Oh, yeah. Although, as you're telling a story, you can often say, you felt that, haven't you? That sense of loneliness, that you felt that. You know what it was like to come in out of the cold? Some of you came here to church, and suddenly you were with a group, folks who shared, you know. It's how you tell it, how you say it. I think. Yeah.
When you into a narrative.
In a narrative, if you're talking about psychological proof, which is what you're doing, the narrative carries it. If the story is believable and these people, then you have the proof built in where you say, I can see that. You know, when it comes to application, you can't do a lot of it if you do a narrative. If you do application, after you come out of a narrative, you've got to use narrative to apply. That is, if I come out of a story and say the story of Hosea, the prophet, Moses' wife, I'm going to apply that. That is, God's pursuing love pursues us even when we don't want to be pursued. If I'm going to apply it, then I'm going to pick up two stories, or a story, two stories, that apply that. Because you cannot, if you go from narrative to abstract applications, you have lost the dynamic of the story.
Will you let the narrative stand alone?
Often. If you set it up right. If you set it up in terms of need and question, and often as this character tells the story, that's the other thing you have to decide. Where is he? Is he in the ancient world telling you the story, asking you to come back? Is he somehow able to come into the 21st century, limited knowledge of the 21st century? But he can often refer to the people and the experiences that they've had. I more often start, bring the character into the 21st century. And so you make application along the way simply by just the observing of life.